eubacteria, which include things like our cyanobacteria from Shark Bay, is photosynthetic organisms, things that you might see in these saline pools in Western Australia or in the springs of Rotorua, or indeed clogging up the Murray Darling with their algal blooms. The other major group you might have found were archaebacteria. These tend to be found today in very extreme environmental conditions, in the deep underground or associated with high salinity environments, high acid swamp environments, or hot springs, or in sulfurous vents in the seafloor. Now, with the activities of these early cyanobacteria on Earth, that had fundamental consequences for the concentration of gases in the Earth's atmosphere. So with photosynthesis, we gradually change from a neutral or reducing atmosphere to an oxygen-rich atmosphere. Now this was bad news for some of these archaebacteria, which didn't like highly oxygenated conditions. So we tend to find them today in areas which are relatively low in oxygen. These ones are from hot springs in Iceland. They can grow in temperatures up to about 110 degrees in some of these thermal springs. But there are other forms that grow that live on the sea floor associated with these sulfurous vents, which under high pressures can survive at temperatures up to 250 degrees Celsius. So some of these early bacteria were probably existing in environmental conditions that we would consider savagely extreme. But it's these conditions which were probably widespread in the early Earth history. And indeed, they might have been widespread on a number of the inner planets. Maybe not Mercury, it seems to be a small planet, fairly stable for a long period of time. But perhaps some of the other planets like Venus, Earth, and Mars might have had a similar early history, but it was their subsequent geological and atmospheric evolution that really only permitted complex life to develop on one of these worlds. Now, although the current series of NASA and Russian Mars probes are not really designed to answer the question of whether there was fossil life on Mars, it's perhaps pertinent to ask where might we go looking for evidence of fossils on Mars? Now, there are probably three principal areas we'd go looking for. One is hot spring deposits, scissor deposits, which have several advantages in terms of looking for fossil life. They represent areas which have probably long histories of aqueous conditions, so continuous bubbling up of groundwaters. The outflow streams probably have quite a range of temperatures. So there's a range of temperatures suitable for organisms to live in. And thirdly, these types of deposits are usually made up of very fine-grained carbonate or silicate materials, which are excellent environments in which to preserve organisms through the process of petrifaction. Second type of place we might look are in evaporite deposits. So, as we've already seen, there are past aqueous channels on Mars. Perhaps we wouldn't go looking in these channel deposits themselves. They're probably more transient sort of deposits of transient water. Perhaps we might go looking in the downstream ends of some of these channels where the water might have potted for extended periods of time, and they would be more likely to show signs of the accumulation of organisms or organic materials. And the third place we might look is deep underground. Many people have speculated that there is water ice trapped within the Martian regolith, and if in the early part of the history of the planet some of these microorganisms were to have found their way into the deep regolith, they might have survived there for some period of time in association with water ice or even liquid ice if it was associated with geothermal activity. So to sum up this part of the talk, is there life on Mars, or was there life on Mars? The evidence so far seems a bit intriguing, but we'd really like some more evidence. And as David was saying, we really need to get some material in situ from Mars so that there can be absolutely no argument about the origin of the rock samples. And due to the constraints of the current series of American and Russian probes, this sort of evidence may be some time in coming, perhaps at least another decade. So with that, I'll hand back to Rachel, and she can talk about the implications of finding life on Mars for more advanced life in the universe.
Okay, well, it's all very well to worry about whether or not there are bacteria on Mars, but I guess the question that you really want to ask is whether or not there's life in some more interesting and recognizable form. And there's many ways of looking at this, and this is one of the ways that I came across recently. It's not Mars, but it's our nearest neighbor, Venus, and quite clearly, at least in some part of the press, there are thoughts that there might be some sort of life form on Venus. But really, from the scientific point of view, we look at it just slightly differently from this. And what I'm going to do now is just take you through a very simple-minded sort of argument that we made to try and understand whether or not there are other intelligent beings somewhere out there in the universe. So the question we ask is, how many intelligent civilizations are there in our galaxy? Now, I'm sure not all of you are astronomers here, and so you may not be familiar with what a galaxy is. Basically, the galaxy we live in is a collection of about 100 billion stars. But our galaxy is not the only galaxy in the universe. Okay, just to put this in perspective, there are lots and lots of galaxies in the universe, and just recently, the Hubble Space Telescope has taken an incredibly deep picture of a part of the universe. And to get some idea of what size of the sky we're looking at here, if you take a grain of sand and hold it at arm's length, that's the area of the field that you're looking at there. So it's a tiny, tiny part of the sky. And what you should see here is that each one of these little fuzzy blobs, and you can see the tiny little ones here, tiny little ones here, each of these is a galaxy just like our own. So even in this picture here, you can probably see close to 1,000 galaxies, and you just imagine the whole sky is plastered with galaxies like that. But we're not asking as big a question as that. We're just asking how many intelligent civilizations in our own galaxy. So if we get a big answer here, the answer for the rest of the universe is positively huge. Okay, so how do we go about working out how many intelligent civilizations there are? Well, what we do is we sort of think in probabilistic terms. We think of what's the probability of each of the factors that we think will be important for the development of life. And there was a chap called Frank Drake who was very interested in this question, and he put together something which is called Drake's equation. And I've got each of the factors Drake's equation drawn out here, and I'm just going to go through and explain to you how he went about putting this out. So he said, well, let's start with our galaxy. This is my rendition of our galaxy here, and there it is with 100 billion stars in it. And the basic idea is then to say, okay, which of those stars has got planets around it? So there's the second factor there, there's the star or the sun, and you ask how many of the galaxies have got planets around it. But it's not just enough to have planets. I'll go on to the next factor first. The planets, we want to know how many planets there are around each of these stars. Now, until about 2 years ago, we really thought there would be planets around stars, but we hadn't actually found any. And this was a bit of a sore point for astronomers. You know, they should have been there. There was no reason why planets should only occur around our sun. But as I say, it wasn't until about 2 years ago that we actually detected the first planets. There are now at least a half a dozen stars around which we've actually detected planets. So we certainly know there are planets. Some of the stars where we've detected planets actually have up to three planets at least that we can detect. So we've got these two factors sorted out. Now the next question is the planet that we've discovered suitable for life? And that's probably a little bit more problematic. What we're really asking there is, you know, is it too hot? Is it too cold? You know, do we really think life would evolve on Jupiter where there's no hard surface? So we're asking questions like that. But we could probably paraphrase it by saying, you know, does the planet, for example, have water on it? If in fact we think water is a key thing in the planet being suitable for life. Now, having got a suitable physical environment lined up, the next thing we've got to ask is, did life form? Well, that's got a big question mark against it. And then the next thing after forming life is, was the life intelligent? Okay, well, what do we mean by intelligent life? Well, at this point in time, we certainly don't mean those little buggy things that Stephen was showing us. We want something a bit more intelligent than that, because what we're actually going to require is that the life that forms here can communicate with us in some way. I suppose we could actually argue that the little buggy things actually did communicate with us if they left something behind, that it was in a rock and it actually got here. So I guess that is one form of communication. But because we're astronomers, we think of communication in much more concrete terms, and what we're actually going to require of them is that they send us a radio signal or something sort of really basic like that and say, I am here, okay? So we're looking actually for intelligence that has some technology behind it and can send out radio signals. Now the final term in this equation is the question of how long does this intelligent civilization last? And most of us actually take this rather seriously these days. So if we assume that we've been intelligent for the last 50 years, because our criteria was, you know, how long have we had radio or radar for, then the question is now, how long are we going to last? And you can see that's my little facsimile of a bomb. I gather we're still letting them off, and presumably we... can't assume that that life as we know it is going to remain around for a very long time. Okay, so that's the last factor. Now, having isolated all the factors, what do we do next? Well, what we do is we try and write a number beside each of those factors. And, you know, numbers aren't really very fashionable, but I thought I'd better write some numbers down here and sort of show you how this all worked out. And I've got two columns here, one of which is the sort of optimistic column and one is the pessimistic column. And what I've done is I've lumped the factors together and I've sort of got the planet factors in this number here, and that's the one that the astronomers are responsible for, and we of course do a good job on that. And then we've got the life factors here. You're supposed to notice that they don't do such a good job on their numbers, so they're a little bit more unsteady. And then the final one down here, on which I think none of us really even have a flying guess, is how long will a civilization last? And just so that we can get a firm number down the end here, I've written down 50 years, right, because that's how long we've lasted so far. So we've got these numbers, and what we can do is we can go down here and multiply them together, and as any of my students will know, I'm usually incredibly bad at arithmetic, so I've probably made a mistake. But anyway, if I've got this right, then basically if we go down the optimistic line, then we get 10,000, and basically that tells us that we've got lots of ETs out there in the galaxy. Okay, so that means that we're definitely not alone. If we go down this pessimistic set of numbers, so these are our worst guesses, then you get 50 over some frankly big number, and what that tells us is we're definitely alone, okay? There's nobody else out there. But so you can see that there's really quite a wide range of possible answers here, from a possibly optimistic one to a fairly pessimistic one. Okay, well, that's the sort of framework that we look at it in. What do we actually do about it? Well, one thing we could do about it, I suppose, is we could go out and look and see if there really is life out there on those planets. So you see a couple of guys here, and they're going out and actually testing to see whether or not life is on the planet or not. But that's a rather expensive way of doing it. And what we as astronomers will do instead is to use the radio option. So how do we go about looking for life at radio wavelengths? Well, there's something called the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which a group of people are undertaking at the moment, primarily Americans, although there is actually some active Australian involvement in this program. And what this is, it's now a privately funded program. The sort of people who've donated money include Steven Spielberg, who is a very keen fan of this sort of work. I guess he's made a lot of money from it, but is it sensible that he should put a little back? And what this program does is actually goes out and it looks for radio signals from these supposedly intelligent life forms. And they rent time on radio telescopes and target nearby stars that possibly might have planets around them on which life might possibly have arisen and may possibly have evolved into some sort of intelligent form. Last year, in 1995, this group came and used the Parkes Radio Telescope for several months, and they have a very sophisticated program, and of course, the bottom line is that they didn't, in fact, find any extraterrestrials. In fact, they found no signature at all of intelligent life. What sort of signature would they be looking for? Well, basically, thoughts that we have on this, suppose that you imagine what sort of signal Earth is sending out at radio wavelengths. And we can do that quite easily just by considering a map of the Earth that we've got here, okay? And the little black dots on the Earth are in fact all the powerful TV antennas that send out the sort of signal, you know, to your television set. And each of those antennas is beaming out, you know, sort of horizontally with the Earth. They do that so that they minimize their losses. And when we gave this talk on last Sunday, I very cleverly said, you know, those little black dots show you where the people are concentrated. This is a bit off, actually. This has nothing to do with where the people are concentrated. It was pointed out this is where the dollars are concentrated. And this is where, in fact, the TV antennas are. And so what you can imagine is that as the Earth spins around, these beams basically come over the horizon, and anybody watching the Earth will get a series of blips coming up each time one of these concentrations of TV antennas comes across the horizon. And so, in fact, Earth, without doing anything at all, is beaming out quite a strong signal, a repeated signal. I don't know whether they could actually pick up neighbours or anything like that, but they'll certainly see that there is a signal coming from Earth and that it's a repeated signal that they might take as a sign of intelligence. However, there is, of course, another way of looking at it. As you can see from this, what it says is, as I read it, we're receiving a message from outer space telling us to stop bombarding them with unintelligible messages. So there are many ways of looking at it. Okay, so this, I think, concludes what I wanted to say about intelligent life. From the astronomer's point of view, of course, you can see from the material that we've been presenting, we don't have any problem with there being life out there. In fact, we've been expecting it for a long time. It's just a question of when and where we find it. But it looks like we've still got to wait just a little bit longer for our friends, the paleobotanists, to actually produce the concrete evidence that we can hang our hats on. Okay. I think that's the end of this section.
Okay, thank you. I would now like to invite discussion on everything that's been said. If there's any more technical questions you would like, then please feel free to ask that now, or any other questions you'd like to like answered, and you can direct your questions to any member of the panel.
I'd like to ask a question of the third speaker. Thanks very much for your presentation. This was the man with the potato. You mentioned that there were a series of coincident observations on that piece of rock, which individually didn't seem to be particularly strong evidence, but collectively might increase your perhaps perception that there could have been life or traces of life in that rock. Is there similar rock with similar coincidences on Earth material?
Yes, absolutely. One of the ideas they had when they were looking in the Mars meteorite was to imagine, well, what if Earth life had been in here? What sort of traces would it leave behind? And there are plenty of old rocks on Earth containing ancient residues of ancient life that have been very well studied. And you see PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, you see little crystals of iron sulfide and iron oxide all mixing together. You see little shapes that are suggestive of fossils or other residues of life processes. So the idea was then, given extensive experience with paleobotany and what have you, let's apply what we know to look in the Mars rocks, and wow, you know, it seems very compelling evidence that those same traces are there. The traces have—it has to be said—the traces are not as strong as what you find in Earth rock, a comparable Earth rock. You do find a lot more complex molecules, a lot more. The traces are a lot stronger. So, but this is just the beginning. You know, this is day one of the investigation. So I'm quite optimistic that. Maybe closer investigation, maybe not on this rock, but particularly on samples returned by unmanned space probes, will look very promising. You have to also keep in mind that this meteorite is taken in context as being, we're sure it's from Mars, we know it's from Mars, we know the history of the planet very well, we know that it was like the Earth in the beginning, we know life did begin here. Well, yeah, we're 100% certain life did. So, you know, if there's nothing more to life than chemistry, sunlight, water, and time is an important factor, then those things all existed on Mars as well. So everything taken together. It's really exciting.
With the finding of the rock and looking at the Viking chemistry of years ago, can we reanalyse that Viking chemistry of the soil and put the two together and come up with some answers to the probabilities that looked like there was life on Earth or on Mars there?
Yeah, look, that's a good question. And in fact, there's a book came out just a few years ago looking more closely at the Viking data. And it seems to me that just as the author of this book proposed, that the results were not 100% conclusive. You did have to propose that there was some unusual chemistry associated with the Martian soil, possibly highly reactive chemicals that had been created by intense ultraviolet radiation at the surface. A whole lot of complicated things had to go on to account for the very strange things that were seen when the nutrients were tipped onto samples of Martian soil. Because it was true that Martian soil, straight off the ground, tipped into these nutrient baths, behaved in one way, and Martian soil first heated up to enormous temperatures to sterilise it and then have nutrients tipped on it, behaved completely differently. And yet it was proposed that the sterilisation process drove off some of the exotic chemicals that were present naturally and accounted for the differences in the results. But the problem with the Viking landers was that you couldn't actually choose where to put the lander on the planet in terms of finding the best place to find living organisms. As we've heard, the surface of the planet is very complicated, and Stephen pointed out you really want to choose your place very carefully. The Americans were absolutely paranoid about a Viking lander coming down. You know, I can imagine a Viking lander coming down right here, and one leg ends up on this table, and the other leg hits the ground. You know, it'll just tip over, and there's $10 billion down the drain because you couldn't find a flat spot to land on. And so they searched the planet very carefully, flattest and most boring and least interesting parts of the planet. And probably, you know, if you're going to land in the middle of the Sahara Desert and take a shovel full of sand and look for life in there, well, you know, it's
hard work, you'd much rather land in the jungle. It's a much more hazardous proposition. So I think it's worth doing that again.
Firstly, if you did land in the Sahara Desert, my understanding is that you would, with the kind of instrumentation we had, discover that there's various bacteria and stuff around in the Sahara. So at least the question of if there was life around in Mars over 3 billion years ago, in sufficient quantities to be detectable on one of 12 random rocks that had arrived at the neighbouring planet, you would have expected it to have evolved considerably in that 3 billion years. You need some sort of account of what happened to it. And I'd expect to hear something about that. But like my picture of life evolving is that it continues to evolve, and that you would expect it to start forming a more suitable environment and creating oxygen and doing whatever's necessary to get on with creating an intelligent civilization. But there's a general tendency for matter to organize itself into more complex structures. So I'd like to hear something about that as to how life would have died out on Mars. Second question on this search for extraterrestrial smoke signals. We've only had radio for 100 years, and if you were thinking about these, you know, people were looking for smoke signals on Mars at the turn of the last century. It seems to me that it was constructive to look around the neighbouring stars, like the closest one's 4 light years away, the next one's 12 light years away. But once you've gone more than 100 light years away, which is only a relatively small number of stars, if you haven't found anything there, it seems reasonable to suppose that whatever's out there either hasn't developed radio, is 50 years or 100 years behind us, or has gone well beyond radio. And why would one put major efforts into looking for radio, which is the equivalent of smoke signals, rather than assuming that anything that develops radio is going to go on and develop something that will be more useful for interplanetary communication? Something that takes 100 years to get to the nearest neighbour isn't very useful for striking up a conversation. And anyone who's developed anything more useful is not going to be interested in looking at these maps.
Okay, let me deal with the first question and one point second, and I'll hand back a moment to Rachel for more detail.
Slip in the third one. Don't you reckon they would have rigged up the apparatus so that the promising signals that first came back would have turned into disappointing ones to keep us away out?
No, I don't think so. First of all, laws of physics say you can't go faster than radio signals. We're just stuck with that. The universe is constructed in such a way you can't communicate.
Yeah, but there were no such things as radio signals 200 years ago.
That's right.
Laws of physics said there weren't any.
No, I don't think they said that. They certainly said there was light. Everyone knew that. Light is just a form of electromagnetic radiation.
Yeah, but it travels in the luminiferous ether.
But anyway, looking at the first question, it's important to keep in mind that the Mars has changed a lot over the last 3.5 billion years, and a lot more than the Earth has changed, because the atmosphere of Mars is all ripped off in space, and it may be that that happened too fast for life to adjust to in evolutionary processes. So it may be true that the planet is now dead. We won't find any life on the surface because it's simply too harsh. The ultraviolet light will dissociate the organic molecules necessary to survive. What's more important, even than finding life presently on Mars, although that's exciting enough, I think it's more important to find that there were traces, at least, of life there to show that at least it got started. And even if the planet didn't cooperate because the gravity wasn't strong enough to hang on to the atmosphere, and eventually died off. So I think the search for fossils should be the primary aim. And if you happen to find living things still there, well, that's a real bonus. Great.
I'm not quite sure which part of what you're saying to respond to. your comments are obviously generally valid. Radio signals aren't necessarily going to be the way to do it, okay? But they're really the best we have. So that's probably the strongest answer. As far as the timescales on which intelligent life might arise, you certainly don't want to assume that just because we've got to this point at this time in history that somebody else might not have got there a million years ago or 10 million years ago. These are very small perturbations in cosmic time. Okay? So, somebody could be way ahead of us, it's true. And it's true they may not want to talk to us with smoke signals. But as I say, it really is, it's the only mechanism that we've got at this stage. And as David said, it's got to be light. and radio waves are a low energy, you know, good low energy form of communication. So it's the best we can do.
Given the life of the rock we've been talking about all evening, you said around 4 billion years or more. Is that right?
Yeah.
Something like that. And the fact that material ejected from Mars is more likely ejected from Mars than from Earth because of the differences in atmosphere and gravity. Hoyle postulated some decades ago that, perhaps tongue-in-cheek, that in fact life came from outer space. Is it possible, if there is life, if that rock in fact does say what it seems to be saying, that perhaps Earth was seeded from Mars?
I'll respond. I mean, Hoyle's suggestion certainly wasn't tongue-in-cheek. I mean, he takes that incredibly seriously and has spent a lot of time working on that, trying to study the impact that there could basically be frozen bacteria in gas clouds out there in outer space. And for those of you who are not familiar with this idea, Hoyle suggests that these, you know, frozen life forms float around in interstellar space, well, in interplanetary space. And that every now and again, for example, Earth passes through a whole cloud of these life forms, so you sort of get them raining down. And this is his argument as to why the same strain of flu virus arises in Hong Kong and New York on the same day. Basically, you know, these are raining down on us from outer space. He doesn't buy the idea that people fly around the world in jets and take their diseases with them. But anyway, and Hoyle thinks that a much more likely place for life to form is in a gas cloud that then seeds the Earth. I think all of this is, basically, if you can figure out where life can form, it's possible that it could form in a gas cloud and Earth was seeded. But it probably doesn't matter terribly much whether it actually formed in situ here or it formed somewhere else. I think the most important issue, probably for most of us, is whether or not life forms easily in a number of different situations. So I think that's really the key issue. If it forms easily here, then it will probably form easily somewhere else. And indeed, I'm sure you can cross-contaminate places. But I think the issue is just how easy it is to form that life.
I want to raise a philosophical point, actually. If we are not religious, then the mere fact that we are here on Earth and exist, and the tremendous numbers of planets that we have heard from Rachel may exist in the universe tells me that there must be life elsewhere. So what's the big excitement? We have heard lots of science fiction and have seen movies and whatnot, and we are disappointed that the life, if it is there, is a little tiny fossil. But to me, number one, I have no doubt that life is somewhere. I have great doubt that the life is found right in our backyard.
Just after being cut to the NASA budget.
I was just wondering, apparently we found this rock in 1984 and we definitely knew it was from Mars. Why is it taken? We didn't know that.
Well, in fact, this meteorite has a very interesting history. It was actually found in 1984 and it's originally misclassified as coming from the asteroid Vesta. Vesta is one of the largest asteroids. It's about 500 kilometers across, and it was large enough to also differentiate and have basaltic crust. And we've been getting quite a number of pieces of Vesta landing here on Earth. In fact, I'm more directly involved in that than the Martian meteorites. When they first found this rock, they saw that it was 4.5 billion years old. At that point in time, they classified it as coming from Vesta because all these Vesta rocks were that old. It wasn't until until someone else started looking a little bit more closely at the mineralogy, and certain minerals were in this meteorite, which are not in any of the other pieces of Vesta. Then they started doing more rigorous testing and actually proved that it was part of the Martian meteorite group. That kind of brings up a problem with science that we tend to pigeonhole things. We tend to pick something up, we think we know what we found, and we put it in the box for 20 years or whatever. And this is a really good argument to, you know, try to keep your mind fresh when you find something like that.
Why is it taking so long for us to
There's basically not enough people working on, like I was saying, how there's hundreds of meteorites found, but there's only a few labs which can do the work, you know. It's a problem of manpower and you know, how many people are putting their interest in this sort of stuff. Money too. But we'll work for
So I'm wondering if there are any forms of life on Earth that are known at the moment, which, if you took them to Mars at the moment, could survive.
I have no idea.
Yeah, well,
Mars
is
an
I was going to make one comment in relation to that, which is, since the Viking mission did fly to Mars, so we were 20 years ago, Our understanding of life has developed very significantly since then, so that we now find life in parts of the Earth where we would never have imagined them to be, it to be possible now, like deep underground in hydrogen-eating life forms in very hot temperatures, or these undersea vents. So I think one of the things that perhaps I would think has come out in the last 20 years is the realisation that life can be very, very robust, more robust than we thought. Not so long ago. Did you agree with that, Steve?
Yeah, you'd never want to underestimate the durability of some of these life forms. But you would not expect anything particularly complicated to survive. The atmosphere is quite different to what we have on Earth. And I think there are a few spots present on Mars where you have much chance of survival, even the simplest of all.
And also keep in mind that, at least for some of the Martian meteorites, the process of ejection shocked them enough to partially melt them to create these glasses. And also the fact that they were floating around for so many millions of years also might help sterilize any Martian meteorites on their way here to Earth, you know, or Earth to Mars.
Yeah, somebody mentioned cross-contamination a while ago. If we've all been around for 4.5 billion years and it's possible for ejecta from Earth to go to Mars and vice versa, like the gentleman over there, I'm surprised that if we find it, it's next door. Isn't it possible that the Earth could either have formed here or there and we're just cross-fertilising each other and it's the same life form originally anyway? In other words, if you look around everywhere else, there's no other life anywhere. It's just that it happens to be too weird because we keep kissing each other or something. And is that statistically more likely than the fact that two of the quadrillion sites that are available happen to have life?
Well, okay, I think the
Lorentz
cycle of the life that they supposedly found in this Martian meteorite is kind of compatible with the sort of life that you might find in a hydrothermal vent, right? And if you would take that rock, you could end those full of its little bacteria and place it anywhere else besides the hydrothermal vent, that light, those little bacteria there would probably die. Especially if you would take that rock and put it into space for a few million years, the life that probably would die on its way to the other planet. But we haven't found living life in this rock. We found maybe evidence that there was life at one time. Though what you said is certainly a very intriguing possibility.
But is your question really, did this life originate on Earth, travel to Mars and then come back again? Or rather the...
No, well, statistically, I mean, like the skeptic over here, I mean, two next-door neighbours are teeming with life, and we can't find anything anywhere else. Is it more likely that...
I mean, we haven't looked anywhere else, you know.
I
mean, the whole universe may be teeming with life.
Yeah.
So all the comment over here is quite valid. If life is rare, right? If life, in fact, is incredibly common, then it'll be everywhere, right? But I mean, that's it really just depends how common life is, and in a sense, that was the point I was trying to get across. This is quite a crucial thing. Will it arise anywhere that it possibly can, or does it only arise in a very few of the possible places that we can? And this is something that we don't know the answer to.
And this is also the content of one of the questions that I put up right at the beginning, is that if we do find life in both places where we look in detail, then it does imply that life seems to develop everywhere. And again, this has very great implications for the Drake equation and the evolution of life. But as Richard said, we haven't looked anywhere else, so we don't know.
But that, just hearing that, there still seems to be, there's still a lot of question about the cross-contamination. Is it really believed that it's virtually impossible for life to survive the transmission? Or perhaps not so much life itself, but some of the exotic chemicals, the precursors to life, that may in some ways be much harder to achieve and maybe rarer, they're what's being cross-contaminated. Did they have survived the trip?
I'm just going to make one further comment on that. I mean, I think the sterilisation process is fairly efficient, so that's already been spoken to. One point that I think we haven't made very strongly is that the reverse process of taking things to Mars is actually quite a difficult one. It's actually rather, it's much easier to take rocks from Mars to Earth than it is by natural processes to take rocks back from Earth to Mars. And there are two reasons for that. The first is it's much harder to eject a rock out of the gravitational pull of the Earth, right, than it is to get it off Mars or off the Moon. You just need a bigger explosion, so it's not going to happen as often, and we've got an atmosphere which will slow things down a bit. But the other important thing is that once the rocks get off Earth, in point of fact, what they want to do is sort of move towards the centre of the solar system, right? Rather than move towards the outer parts of the solar system. Okay, so the time that they spend will tend to be in the inner part from where they're ejected. So we probably would send our rocks to Venus, for example, or they might impact on Mercury. They're quite unlikely to go in the other direction.
But these arguments are explaining why Earth could not have seeded Mars. But what if Earth life didn't start on Earth? It started on Mars, and we were seeded from Mars. That argument...
Possible.
Or it could have come from outer space through a Hoyle hypothesis.
Yeah.
There's one other point to put this in perspective. There are a whole lot of guys in Nevada who have run calculations about just how big a meteorite impact it would take on Mars to eject material into space that could land on Earth. And they calculated to take an impact powerful enough to create a crater which is 100 kilometres in diameter, and that's a very major impact on Mars. You scale that up to the surface of the Earth, given its higher gravity and thicker atmosphere and the lower probability of stuff going back up the gravitational hill. And I think it's the probability of going down.
But I'm still saying it doesn't necessarily... Like, the seeding argument is not ruled out by saying it's very hard to do it from Earth,
right,
because it could have started from Mars.
That's right.
Do we know how big that meteor was before it hit the Earth, in terms of its the heat?
That's a good question. Some meteorites are made of pure iron, and they can more or less punch through our atmosphere without evaporating much of the mass. The other extreme is the carbonaceous chondrites. They're very weak and friable, and most of the shooting stars that you see are made of this very, very more like a charcoal briquette more than anything else. The basaltic ones are more or less halfway in between. And depending on how fractured the meteorite was, tells you how strong. But you really wouldn't expect more than about half the mass to be ablated through re-entry. But if the meteorite had already had a lot of fractures in it,
what sort of temperature would it have reached in its passage through the atmosphere?
It reached several thousands of degrees of the skin, but the actual plunging of the atmosphere only happens on the order of tens of seconds. So it isn't really the heat in that time to really penetrate very far.
There was some talk in newspapers about okay, this rock was, you know, like 3,000 years. What's the chances of this life process coming from Antarctica and not so much?
That was a really good question, because that's the first thing that I'm sure went through the scientist's mind. Because this sort of announcement, you know, you save your career on, and has it to turn out to be terrestrial contamination, would have been the worst blunder imaginable. So one of the ways to try to rule that out is they had this concentration of organic material. If it was terrestrial contamination, you'd expect it to seep from the outside in, and so you would find it more near the surface. Where in fact, if anything, if the opposite was true, there was more of this of the evidence that's actually sealed inside the rock then. And of course, they didn't break open the rock till it was in a completely controlled environment. So hopefully, they ruled out terrestrial contamination.
If we're looking for life as we know it, how do we know that the life we find on Mars isn't what we brought along with us?
Sorry, what was it?
Well, if we, for example, when the Vikings landed on Mars and the data that they sent to us, how do we know that maybe the life that they found or will seem to be found aren't like bacteria that they brought from Earth?
Viking landers were sterilized very, very carefully before launch. They were kept in sealed environment when they were loaded onto the rockets. The Americans, for many, many years, up until the late 70s, were extremely careful to sterilize all objects that were likely to crash into another planet. So the Viking landers, the mariners, the surveyors, all those early space probes were sterilized with intense gamma radiation, washing in acids and all these other sorts of things. And in fact, the Americans only stopped doing that in the late 70s when they discovered that the Russians had no such show. But I think we can be pretty sure that the Vikings were sterile when they landed on Mars.
But if we actually had physicists going up to Mars, then they would probably bring some kind of life forms with them.
Yeah,
sure. Well, also, keep in mind that this meteorite hit the Earth 13,000 years ago, much before the Viking landers.
Two more questions.
Just the numbers on SETI. I know you said your arithmetic wasn't really good, but it'd probably be better than mine. If the most optimistic said that there were 10,000 possible intelligent life forms in our galaxy, pessimistic was almost zero. But that's 10,000 in 100 billion stars. But that's not that close to zero anyway. It's probably not worth even having a look for.
Well, one of the things I should say about those numbers is I've factored in a lifetime for the civilization of 50 years, right, which is quite a short lifetime. I think most of us really hope that we're going to be around a bit longer than that. And so, you know, for example, if we were really around for, you know, 10,000 or 50,000 years, then you could add quite a lot more noughts to that number that I put there. So the 10,000 in the 100 billion, I agree, is a rather small number, but you know, if civilizations, you know, if we get our act together and actually manage to survive a while, then that number would presumably be much, much larger.
I have an economic question. I wonder if, in your opinion, it's worth the money to send astronauts to Mars to look for more life-giving tubules and forms in those years, or would it be better off to spend the money to preserve the planet here?
That's an extremely good question, and I think you answered the question. I mean, what you know, why do anything? Why pay your mortgage? Why do anything? In fact, I think it's investigations like this which make life worth living. It's exciting, it's interesting, it shows there are things outside of the planet, outside of us. It boggles the imagination, and I think it's worth spending the money on. You look at the American military industrial complex, and it's just completely beyond reason what they're doing and what they've done. You know, why do we need to be able to destroy the planet 10 times over? You know, once would be enough. So I see this as a very fertile area where some of that enormous industry, which has just been squandered and wasted, can be diverted into channels which are, you know, quite uplifting and
improve the quality of life in a very real way.
I think that's probably an excellent note to end this meeting. So thank you for coming. And,